This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On Air.
Welcome to Books Uncovered, an exciting conversation about books and literary events, brought to you by the Dunedin Athenaeum Library and Mechanics Institute.
I'm Holly.
And I'm Bella.
Over the next half hour, we'll dive into themes ranging from romance to quirky book blurbs, all discovered within the depths of the Athenaeum Library.
Kia ora.
Kia ora, everyone.
Thanks for tuning in on probably what is a really cold Dunedin day. I'm assuming it's going to be like that tomorrow.
Yeah, I feel like it's here to, it's settled in.
Yeah, bit of snow. It's a sad day because it's our last show.
It is. Did we say that we were finishing?
I think we did a few episodes ago. Mm. So I think we've done about 50-something episodes, which is a bit wild. It is, eh? I was like, that's a lot of, you know, pulling apart books and elevating them and ripping them up. but yeah, I mean, it's a goodbye for now, but it's not a forever goodbye. We may come back.
You may hear our sultry tones back.
Exactly. Soon. And especially if, well, he's hoping no one steals our wonderful name of Books Uncovered.
It's copyrighted, actually.
Yeah. So yeah, we're doing a bit of a random show of, well, yeah, we haven't quite themed it yet, have we? I guess we're just calling it End of the Road.
End of the line for now.
So we've got two books each to talk about.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, did you want to kick us off with
the first book? So my first book I want to talk about is one that I've been very excited to read for since I heard it was coming out, and it is London Falling by Patrick Radden Keefe, who is one of my favourite ever nonfiction writers. I've talked about his book Say Nothing before, which was about the Troubles in Ireland, and how much I loved it. And this is another excellent example of his mastery of the craft, I think. I love this one. And I think there are very few nonfiction writers working at the moment that I've read who really inspire the kind of trust that he does, that he'll take the threads of a story and pull them into something like really readable, interesting, and just like, yeah, pull so much out of a story and like expand it into a really amazing way of looking into all these different aspects of society. Mm. So this is his new one, just came out a month or two ago. So it's on paper, it's a true crime, a pretty straightforward true crime story. And I think this is based on this, I know this is based on an article he wrote, I think for the New Yorker or one of those
literary
esteemed publications that he's now expanded out into a book. So in 2019, the body of 19-year-old Zach Brettler was discovered near the Thames after he apparently fell from the balcony of a luxury London apartment owned by this sort of shadowy, dangerous criminal figure. But then pretty much almost immediately after that happens, the facts stop lining up clearly. Zach had this broken jaw, which was inconsistent with the fall, and the men connected to the apartment didn't know him as Zach Brettler, who was the son of an affluent North London family, but as Zach Ismailov, who was supposedly the heir to a Russian oligarch's fortune. So somewhere along the way, he'd constructed this really elaborate double life for himself.
Wow.
That sort of placed him in this orbit of gangsters and grifters and like the real underbelly of London.
And he's 19.
Yeah.
Gosh.
And like the shadow economy that surrounds London's ultra wealthy elite. So yeah, he uses that as this springboard into pulling on the threads until the entire story around the central like happening unravels. What I really loved about it is like it's really massive in scope. Like he talks about so much different stuff, but it's also really intimate. So you have this. It's a really researched descent into London's like billionaire-fueled criminal underworld, and like the way post-Soviet wealth flooded into London, and this culture of like oligarch money and then luxury real estate and organized crime, and how they're all like really intertwined. And I thought it was really fascinating to read about that part of London.
Like, what kind of history does the author have? Like, is he a So he's Irish, and
I think he's American. Okay. But we were with Irish ancestry.
Yeah,
okay. I think was what led him into writing about the Troubles. Deep
research.
Yeah, he's been a journalist. So.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. That makes sense.
And all of his books have sort of come out of articles he's written for publications that are then like, oh, there's actually
more in here.
Heaps here, yeah. Like. Yeah, and it's just another example. I love his books. Like, I don't know if I talked about on here, but his book, which I'm forgetting the name of, but he wrote a really amazing one about the Sackler family and, like, the opioid epidemic in America, which is an excellent book and just a really good example of how he has these, like, central people as the characters and then uses them to sort of bring you into the story and like talk about all other stuff, but with the person at the center.
Yeah.
Okay. What I love about his writing is that you feel really connected to it. He really humanizes everything that he's talking about through these people. So yeah, that's, and this is really like a story a lot about grief of his family as well, and how there's like what you can't know about a person and like how this happened to their son. And it's about them sort of coming to terms with the fact that he had this insane double life and like what led him to that. And
how long did he have the double life for? Or is it getting
it was like, stuff? No, it was like at least like a year or 2 years.
Gosh. Yeah. Amazing. Must have been a very smart young person.
Yeah. It's really wild. Like all the stuff, all the different layers that come out. And it also talks a lot about his family history as well, because he is the grandson of two survivors of Auschwitz as well. So it's about their family history and like how that's affected, like that trauma runs through their families still. I don't want to say too much more. I really recommend it. Cool.
I want to buy it for the library.
Yeah, you should.
Where did you get a copy?
I bought a copy on audiobook, actually.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Oh, it's a good audiobook one.
It is, I think. He read it himself, yeah.
Cool, okay.
Which is fun. Highly recommend this one. I knew it would be good, but it met my expectations. Oh. So that's London Falling by Patrick Graydon Keefe.
Great.
And what's your one?
Well, mine are a lot more basic. they're two books that I bought in for the Athenaeum Library, who are the people who sponsor this show.
Thank you, Athenaeum.
Who we love. And yeah, I'm like, which one do I talk about first? The one I didn't like or the one... I'll talk about the one I didn't like, so we're not ending on like. So I read, I bought this for the library. It's by a writer called Daisy Johnson. She's a English author, and it's called The Hotel. I actually got her confused with another Daisy English writer who's called Daisy Lafarge, who wrote Love Bug and Paul, who's quite sort of an academic kind of writer. So I was reading this book, The Hotel, thinking, this doesn't seem like the same person. And yeah, no, it wasn't the same person. But she's still very prestigious in her own right. She was one of the youngest nominees for the Booker Prize in 2018.
Hmm.
Also Eleanor Catton was also a youngest nominee for that prize as well. Yeah. Neither did I. Anyway, so this book started out as a broadcast for the BBC radio, and like a sort of, I guess they had like little segment series of it, and it came out in lockdown. It's made up of 15 tales, and it's sort of novella size, so it begins with like what we know about the hotel. It's a gothic tale where myths, rumours and secrets lurk, built on cursed land. So different people react differently to the hotel. For some it's just a hotel, but for others there's this magnetism that's impossible to ignore. They're like drawn to the hotel. Sometimes, yeah, after visiting the hotel, people are haunted forever, or like some people never leave. so it's built on the Fens, and I didn't know what the Fens is, but the Fenlands is the eastern England, part of eastern England, where it's naturally marshy and has like a rich ecology, but it was drained like quite a few centuries ago.
Oh, okay.
This the It's basically a short story collection, but it's using the hotel as the world in which these stories, I mean, it's all based around the hotel. Mm-hmm. For me, yeah, each tale is a different character, but this is where I felt like it kind of let the whole book down because each voice sort of blurred into the same one. There was no real definition of the cleaner being anything different from the woman who's attending a hens do. Mm. Like they all just sort of seem like the same person. Yeah, I think the focus was really sort of on the tale of the myth of the hotel. For example, yeah, there's like a hens do, some teenagers go thrill seeking with a video camera, which seemed really like Blair Witch.
Yeah.
The cleaner gets lost in the infamous room 63. So the room 63 is like, yeah, there was one story that was like, yeah, that's quite creepy. I think maybe because it was told from like a child's perspective, which always, yeah, seems a bit off. Because, yeah, I was expecting, you know, people were like, oh, I read this in one sitting and with the lights turned low, it's a gothic tale and it's scary and stuff. But I just, yeah, it just kind of failed in that department for me.
Yeah, I don't like when all the characters could be the same person in a different setting. I'm like, what are you doing?
Yeah, it was, I had to kind of go, oh, hang on, they are meant to be different characters, but yeah, it just was the same voice for me. Yeah, I had some good reviews in The Guardian, comparison to Shirley Jackson's The Haunting of the Hill and the Haunting of Hill House. And it says, but Johnson is more accomplished stylist than Jackson. Her sentence is more elegant and impactful. Her project, more ambitious and literary folk horror, from M.R. James through The Wicker Man to the likes of Andrew Michael Hurley and Zoe Gilbert, is another clear influence. So, yeah, that's pretty grandiose. That's
it, yeah, like, please.
yeah, it was an interesting concept for a short story. Yeah, I just felt like it kind of, it just surfaced.
Yeah, a bit. I delivered on the...
Yeah, or maybe just a bit commercial, like, okay, it was received well as a BBC drama. I mean, they probably had different voices and things, so,
yeah,
and noises, and I can imagine it would play out well in that way, but as a piece of literary fiction, I don't know if you call it, yeah, I mean, you're assuming it would be a literary fiction. Yeah, it failed. Anyway, so yeah, that's Daisy Johnson, The Hotel.
Okay.
Very light read. I mean, maybe it's a transit read.
Read that on the bus. Yeah, I'm intrigued. I'm kind of interested because that is a very glowing review from The Guardian.
And it had long...
And I love gothic fiction.
Right.
But I think also it's a very easy one to, like, miss...
To get a bit wrong.
Yeah.
Lauren Groff had a soundbite on it as well, who I love Lauren Groff. Yeah, so...
Maybe I'll try to listen to the audio version.
Yeah.
I feel like a wee gothic horror story would be, or spooky, would be fun in that format.
Yeah, and because some of the stories are just a couple of pages longer, and some of them are longer. Yeah, just kind of, yeah. Anyway.
Yeah.
Well, what's the next book you've got there?
So my next book is called Fruit Fly by Josh Silver. And this is one you should also buy for the library, okay. I think. So Josh Silver is a mental health nurse from England, and he previously has been the author of several young adult novels, but this is his adult debut. And I heard about this novel because he came to speak at the Auckland Writers' Festival, and a few people I follow through various places in the internet were talking about how interesting his talks were. And so I picked this one up.
Were you at the Auckland Writers' Festival this year?
No, I just heard about it through.
Oh, right.
I read reviews of the festival. I wish I was there.
Hang on a minute.
They're in my heart.
Did I miss this?
So the novel follows Mallory, who is a bit of a one-hit wonder author, and she's struggling with writer's block, trying to find the inspiration for her second novel. So she goes on Reddit, and Reddit tells her that if she wants a bestseller, she needs to go gay, go sad, and go dark. And so she creates the fake Grindr profile using her husband's pictures, and then gets invited to a gay chemsex party, encounters Leo, who's her other protagonist, and who is a young gay addict and sex worker, and then begins to stalk him with the intention to mine his life for material for her novel.
Wow.
And then what follows is, as you can imagine, a very chaotic, twist-filled satire that then quickly spirals into something even darker and stranger. And more emotionally complex as the two characters' lives intertwine and they sort of become a dark reflection of each other's pain in different ways. So, yeah, at his heart, Fruit Fly is asking the question about who gets to tell certain stories and who profits from them. So this
it's a great name now that I know it is a great about. Name. It's yeah. such an apt name.
So it's a lot. It gets mentioned a lot alongside R.F. Kuang's Yellow Face, and that comparison's made in reviews and in a lot of the publishing write-ups. You know how every day now they have to write on the back of a book. It's just like this book.
Yeah.
So this is the book for that.
Do you think that didn't used to be a thing where books weren't like, if you liked this, it would be like that?
Yeah, that's
now it's more of a...
Well, at least not to the extent it is now. I feel like every novel, especially I saw him working in the bookshop, it was like everything was like, just like this book. So yeah, you have to have something for people to like,
people already
to contextualise
it. It's so strange, yeah. It's like people have to kind of know what to expect.
It's like, yeah, and it's also like the books are still completely different. It's just, it doesn't. There's a pet peeve of mine that everything has to be compared to something else now, which I guess we've been doing forever, but it just feels more pushed upon.
I have to do it for a submission to a publishing press to say to compare what my manuscript's like to other work. Starts at that level.
I guess they'll be like,
how does
I think it, like it's like will this yeah it's like will it sell what's selling at the moment, which is kind of grim, but which this book kind of talks about.
True.
So yeah, the Yellow Face is that comparison's made a lot, which is also a novel that explores authenticity and exploitation and the appetite for trauma in the publishing industry. And I mentioned that he was at the Auckland Writers' Fest and he actually did do a panel with R.F. Kuang about identity in fiction. So in Yellow Face, just if you haven't heard of it or read it, it's about a struggling white author who steals her dead and successful Asian-American friend's unpublished manuscript, then rewrites it and publishes it under an ambiguous pen name. So R.F. Kuang is an Asian-American woman, so she's, also sort of a commentary on the authentic authorial voice in fiction. And yes, they both raise the questions of, like, for creatives, how should the privileged demographic represent the less powerful minority? And then is it ethical for them to profit from their stories? And I was reading an interview where Silver was talking about how when he was reading Yellow Face, he realised how much his gay community has been fetishised over the past 10 years. And so that really inspired him to write this book, sending up that fetishization and also the publishing industry as well. And I think he does that very successfully here. And he also had a comment that I thought was quite funny where he was like, I recognize that a gay 9 years sober addict writing a book from the point of view of a straight woman who was writing a book from the point of view of a gay addict is very meta. I was like,
yeah, I was going to say it's so meta.
Yeah.
That's
amazing. It's really good. It's really twisty. The pacing is great. I read it in like 1.5 sittings. You just like speed through it. Its humor is really sharp and self-aware and it's very unhinged. And yeah, it's a really, explores its themes really well. The characters are all really nuanced. And even though it's like these really sort of intense, wild situations, they sort of get pushed through in a believable way. So I think he's written that really well. Yeah, I would say it's a masterclass in controlled chaos and definitely one of the sharpest literary satires I've read in a while.
Oh,
so yeah, that's Fruit Fly by Josh Silver.
Interesting. Yeah, you're making me remember when I was talking about that book, Speak to Me of Home by Jenny Cummings, is it? Wrote on a a Mexican immigrant coming to America and she got a lot of grief about it.
Yeah. This is definitely, there's a lot of things I can think of, like A Little Life, which is in lots of books that, what's her name? The author of A Little Life writes about trauma riddled gay men, particularly. She loves to write about.
Yeah, it's such a bizarre thing, eh? Because then it's like, well, authors are to have an imagination, but then how far, like, how much of someone else's clothes are you allowed to put on as an author, if that's a way to think of it. Oh, my brain's thinking about it anyway.
So yeah, that's that one. That was cool. It was a fun snappy read there.
I'll have to get it. Had some
good things to say. Yes,
brilliant recommendations here. My last book ever. Well,
after this, we're never reading again.
Yeah, I know. Total hiatus. I have been looking at the International Booker Prize shortlist.
Mm-hmm.
And so this book comes from that list. It's called The Witch by Maria Ndiaye, I think is how you pronounce her last name. It's Ndiaye. She's French. I think it was written in French first. And it was actually first published in 1996, which I didn't realize. And had kind of a mediocre reception when it came out then. And so this is a new – is this translated by someone different from the 1996 version? So this is translated by someone called Jordan Stump. And, yeah, obviously it's had a really good reception because it got on the international shortlist. Yeah, it's like novella-sized. I really enjoyed reading this one, firstly because witches.
Yeah, always good stuff.
And the way the story unfolds, it kind of ended up reminding me a little bit of Leonora Carrington's The Hearing Trumpet, and things start to get a little bit weird. Like it's still based in the real world, but they're just a little bit twisted. It's like
a bit of magical realism or something. Or?
Yeah, kind of. Because she's a witch, right?
But, yeah, I guess it's implied.
But then, yeah, when you read the back, it's like, oh yeah, she's a failed witch, so maybe it's. Anyway, so yeah, on one level, it's a story about a married woman who has two 13-year-old twins, two girls, and it's like quite a domestic kind of setting. It's like the trapped wife and mother who's lost her sense of self. She's moved to the suburbs 2 years ago. Her husband works at like some country club signing members up to like holiday deals, and he seems like a bit of a schmuck. But she hasn't been able to find work. So it's kind of, you know, it sort of starts in this domestic. And she's got this really, hang on, I'm jumping ahead of myself. She comes from like a long line of witches. So her mother's really talented, but she doesn't use her powers. And, Lucille, powers are quite below average. So she's sort of semi-failed. Yeah, there's kind of like an underlining vibe of the wife mum feeling a bit inadequate. So yeah, she's got this neighbour, Isabel, that kind of just pops up all the time, and there's this sort of, again, that annoying domestic scene. But then Isabel's role kind of changes as the book goes on, and I guess it kind of adds into the weirdness. And there's a lot of humour in it as well. Like one of the first scenes is Isabel's child being there, and she's aware of the main protagonist being a witch, and so her powers basically are like she can see into the future, but just a little bit and nothing like that significant. And she can kind of see that her neighbor's kid's not going to amount to anything. And the neighbor is just so awful to her child. It's, yeah. So there's a lot of humor in it, actually. So it starts off like Lucille. Sorry, I don't know how to pronounce her French name. Let's just call her Lucy. Is training her two 13-year-olds up on their magic abilities. It kind of starts from that, and then it gets like quite weird. The daughters are quite clearly going to surpass her magical abilities, and she's kind of like scared of them. And then her husband leaves and everything starts to unravel, and then she's very much on her own. Yeah, it gets quite weird. I think it's done in a really wonderful way. Sort of like she writes with this gentle approach to like the terror and sorrow of like a mediocre life. I think she does that really well. I mean, the witch aspect is kind of just a minor thing. I wouldn't call it like magical realism or anything. I think it's more sort of about the domestic side of like a woman being quite trapped by her situation. But then, yeah, because even her parents are quite interesting characters as well, especially the mother.
Yeah.
The daughters are kind of like the most witchiest aspect of it in a way.
Yeah.
Like even the way that like her observations on her daughters are quite, interesting as well.
Like that sounds
kind of othering of her daughters. Like she's, they're like perfect. Mm. These twins.
Spooky.
Yeah.
No, scary twins. Scary, yeah, with scary 13-year-old girls.
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
So the Booker Prize International has been a banger this year.
Yeah, so because you were telling me you were reading the Taiwan Travelogue.
Yeah, which I loved. I was going to write about that, and then I read Fruit Fly. I was like, I want to write about this one.
Yeah, I'm about 100 pages in the Taiwan Travelogue, and it's a lot about food.
Yeah, and I fully got, because it's like written as though it's an older book that's now being retranslated, and I hadn't read anything about it really, so I was like, oh, I hadn't ever heard of this Japanese novelist. And then I got to like the last afterward, and I was like, oh, that's all part of the novel.
We're running out of time. Well, we've run out of time. Oh. It's the end of the road.
Thank you so much to everyone who has listened over our 50-ish episodes.
Yeah, it's been
really appreciated.
Much appreciated. We know we've got some fans, so shout out to those people. And I don't think this will be a forever. It's just like a pause, perhaps.
I'll see you later.
And, oh, I should just mention before we go that the Athenaeum Mechanics Institute has new membership prices. So we have a student and a community services card membership price, which is half price, which is $35.
Amazing.
For the year.
That's so good.
It's worth doing, and they buy really great books. And, yeah, we would love to see you visit us, even if it's just out of curiosity or whatever. Bella, thanks so much for being my co-host.
My pleasure. Thanks for being mine.
It's quite sad. Yeah, gonna miss. And thank you to Aura as well. Like, everyone that works here is just so amazing and supportive and
the most welcoming.
Yeah,
lovely people.
Yeah, yeah. It's been a really amazing journey. And yeah, I guess that's it.
Thank you, everyone.
Have a great weekend.
Bye.
Bye.
Books Uncovered. Exciting conversations about books and literary events. Brought to you by the Dunedin Athenaeum Library and Mechanics Institute.
Join us, Holly and Bella, every second Saturday at 12 p.m. as we dive into themes ranging from romance to quirky book blurbs, all discovered within the depths of the Athenaeum Library.
That's Books Uncovered.
Saturdays at 12 on ORFM and online at oar.org.nz.
This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On Air.